Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. This is Annika Smith, broadcasting from the CSC in Seattle. And on today's show, we feature part one of an interview with CSC Senior Fellow Benjamin Weicker, author of the new book, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World.
Well, welcome to ID the Future. This is Annika Smith, and I have here on the phone Dr. Ben Weicker, who has just written 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't Help. Thank you, Dr. Weicker, for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Now, right off the bat, we have to start out. You're a writer, you're an author, a philosopher, a professor formerly. You're not calling for these books to be burned or banned. What is the premise of how do we deal with these books that really messed up our society?
Well, first of all, let's deal with the censorship thing. That's what everyone is going to ask. Oh, you must be, you know, trying to have a big pyre out in your backyard and we're going to have a party. That's not it at all. In fact, it's just the reverse. And I say this right at the beginning of the book, is I want people to read these books that have screwed up the world because they have so formed every aspect of our culture, intellectually, you know, artistically, morally, that we don't even recognize these as strange and damaging ideas. And so what is needed and what I hope happens with this book is that people do read the books. You know, of course, they read my book, and then they read the books that I'm talking about and see, you know, these bad ideas in seed form. Now, interestingly, you know, this is a good story because the censorship has actually occurred in reverse. I found in this book, and I've been a little shocked. I was right down to the line and, you know, writing this book, trying to get it on deadline. And I'm telling you, we weren't a week away from sending it to the printers. And the Kinsey Institute sent me a notification that I was denied permission to quote from Kinsey's mail report. They want his work. No, and his book's in print. I mean, it's not, you know, his book's in print.
Right, and it's out there, and
yeah, it's not like I'm and I was quoting big sections of it, but I wasn't quoting it out of context. Of course, they knew I was going to be critical of it, but you know, that's life. If you put words out there in the public sphere, you can't run around and protect them. They have to be open to analysis and criticism, which is what I was doing. Now that's a little dark there, you know. and here's another interesting example of it. If you go to Planned Parenthood's website and you look for Margaret Sanger's book, The Pivot of Civilization. Now, Margaret Sanger is the founder of Planned Parenthood.
Right.
And you would think, okay, well, of course your founder's books are going to be on there, right? You know, that would be, you can't find it on there. And there's a reason. Yeah. Now, happily, I have been able to quote from that at length because it's public domain, so it can't be censored. But Planned Parenthood does not want you to read that book. And, you know, we can get into why.
Right. Well, it's interesting how people want to avoid the history of ideas and where the basis of these philosophies are coming from. We can get into that a little later with Darwin and also Hitler and that connection that people are seeking to deny quite a bit with the expelled controversy.
Absolutely, yeah.
But let's start out with your chapter on Hobbes. You note the importance of understanding Hobbes' new creation myth, that Hobbes' state of nature, that it's a fiction, and that it was designed to counter the current sort of biblical worldview on our origin story. Why are these origin stories important to understanding philosophy, and what do they have to do with all these books?
That's a great question, because the book is set up so that you see the way that ideas infect later ideas and so on down the line. And one pattern you see, and you rightly stated, it's kind of a counter myth in these various writers, that is, they're obviously antagonistic to Christianity. In fact, all religion, almost all are atheists, but certainly all of them were anti-Christian. And what you find them doing is providing a kind of counter story about origins. And that becomes an image by which they understand what a human being is, what good and evil is, and what the goal of human life is. Now, that's really dangerous when you realize that these stories they're telling are really mythological. They have no basis, in fact. None at all. And this is as true from Hobbes' State of Nature, which I'll talk about in just a second, to Marx's communist utopia. They are things that really are fantasy, yet when people embrace them and they become the image by which they understand what a human being is, it leads to all kinds of atrocities.
And they're very powerful fantasies.
Yeah, they are. And it's odd, you know, that you have this this long-standing movement to talk about the beginning of Genesis as a mere myth, when in modernity you find, you know, in each of these figures, another story is told which has less claim to truth and has been extraordinary, each of them in their own way, been extraordinarily destructive. Now, let's go to Hobbes. This is Thomas Hobbes, who's writing, he's an Englishman, interesting man, writing in about the middle of the 1600s. He's one of the first full-blown materialists. That is, you can call him Marx and Darwin's great-great-great-grandfather.
Right, and this is Hobbes' Leviathan.
This is Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, and it's a book chock full of almost every bad idea. You know, between two covers, it's almost too bad to be true, you know, that they're all there in one under one cover. But he tells this story about human origins that is anti-Genesis account, where human beings are born into what he calls the state of nature, and everyone is antagonistic to everyone else. And in this so-called state of nature, he declares, there is no good and evil. And he never mentions God. There's no God. There's no creator God. There's no good and evil. And all human beings are fundamentally antagonistic to each other. Again, there's no morality. That's his picture of what it means to be a human being. That's our natural state. Now, on top of that, he does something which is one of the most pernicious things that has ever occurred. And it's so difficult for us to see because we are so Hobbesian. He argues that in this state of nature where there is no morality, before there is any law or government, we all have the right to get anything or do anything we want. We can kill anybody because we don't like the way he looks, and then we can eat him on top of that. You know, there's no... He does say, we have the right to one another's body. And that's what he means. He means cannibalism. And so he envisions our natural state to be one of complete immoral or amoral chaos. But he claims in that we each have the right, the natural right, to get and do whatever we want. And that becomes the historical foundation for our modern notion that society is just a bunch of rights-bearing individuals, and the goal of government is to give everybody whatever they want. And they claim a right to it, whether it's to have Bob marry John, or whether it's to get an abortion, or whether it's to do some kind of horrible thing in the name of art and claim freedom of speech, and that you have a right to that. Hobbes is the foundation of that notion that makes common life so difficult, because if everyone claims a right to do anything, and the government's job is to maximize those rights, you can't have a society last for long. You're just going to go down in smoke where everybody is suing everybody else, which is basically what, you know, we're undergoing.
Right. That's a very grim picture.
It is a grim picture, but Hobbes was a grim man.
And the story of human origins, Hobbes's origin story, is very different than Rousseau's, which you deal with in the next chapter. But they kind of end up sort of with the same...
It does. It's a variation on a bad theme.
Yeah.
And Rousseau, he's writing about 100 years later. He says, oh, no, Hobbes, you're wrong. It wasn't our original, our natural state, wasn't chaos, as you suggest. And the reason is, we were so animal-like. Now, here's where you're getting a premonition of Darwin. We were so animal-like that we didn't really have many desires at all. Okay? So Rousseau's state of nature is one in which human beings have no natural attachment to each other. They kind of wander around. It's a non-moral state. There's no talk about God. But they have a kind of animal-like existence where they want nothing more than to feel certain kinds of pleasures, like sexual pleasure, and eat, basically, and sleep. Okay? He says, this is our happiest time. That condition. Well, what that does is it sets up the view that, and he is historically responsible for setting up this view, that really our happiness is set against society. Society for Rousseau is a bad thing. The love of a man for a woman is a bad thing. It's not natural. The love of parents for children is a bad thing. It's not natural. Marriage and the family are bad things. They're unnatural, and in fact, they are the source of all human misery. Well, that is about as opposite to the Genesis account you can get. Right? Instead of having a male and female being created by a loving God to themselves partake in procreation and bring more human beings in a loving family, what you have for Rousseau is basically something a little above the ape, kind of wandering around and having sex whenever, you know, the mood strikes him, and then he has no connection to the woman or to the children. Well, if you live with that notion that, gosh, that really would be the best, huh? What are you going to think about the family? Well, you're going to think that the family is a burden. A man is going to think that the best condition is to sort of going from one debauched, connection to another with no moral connections where he has any kind of familial duties. Well, that doesn't sound a lot different from our society now, does it?
No, not so much.
We got a bunch of Rousseaus out there. And Rousseau himself, by the way, you know, had just a string of mistresses and fathered five children by one of them, put them all in foundling homes where they probably all died. Why? Because that is the image of what it meant to be. You know, this is happy. I don't have to worry about, and these are his terms, these brats. Well, that makes him the father of abortion, too. Because you start to view children rather than being a gift, they're a burden.
And a disposable one at that.
Yeah. Morbid stuff.
Really?
However, I try to be at least witty, during this, so in other words, you have to have some levity during all this in the book, so it's not all darkness.
No, but it can be hard to be to find that levity when you're dealing with the Communist Manifesto and
yeah. I mean
these are really destructive ideas and philosophies. I want to go back to something you said earlier that Rousseau was historically responsible. Are philosophers and writers, are they responsible for the actions? I mean, obviously Rousseau's responsible for his own family, but are they responsible for the actions of those who imbibe their philosophies?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a common intellectual move that says, oh no philosopher can control all the way that his thought will be used. Well, sure, okay, I understand that. I mean, somebody could misuse something. But the followers of Marx weren't misusing Marx. The followers of Rousseau weren't misusing Rousseau. The followers of Darwin's eugenic program weren't misusing Darwin. You know, therefore, the original thinkers are responsible. Absolutely. And that's why I make so many historical connections so you can see the chain of responsibility. Nobody should get off the hook. And that makes philosophy a rather serious effort. I mean, to me, that's the wisdom of somebody like Plato and Aristotle. They understood that your words can be both taken badly and taken well, but even so, you have a moral burden to know the truth, but also to speak the truth in such a way that it doesn't become malformed.
That was CSC Senior Fellow Ben Weicker on the historical responsibility of philosophers in part one of our interview on his new book, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World. Stay tuned for part two when Dr. Weicker explains the specific impact of Darwin on these destructive philosophies. For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith signing off from the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.